Talk given Saturday, 7th October 1972.
From our childhood onwards, we hear this phrase, appearances are deceptive. Our minds are so conditioned by constantly hearing the phrase that we don't try to discover whether indeed appearances are deceptive. We take it for granted that appearances are deceptive. And not only us and the ordinary people of the world as a whole take that statement for granted, but great philosophers and thinkers and teachers have also said that appearances are deceptive. If you look at various religious philosophies, they talk of this world as the unreal, and that world, whatever that world may be, as the real. That we are deceived by everything that we see and experience in this world. And because of that deception, we imagine that this world is the only world or the real world. Whereas in actual fact, they say that world is the real world. So we get this separation between appearance and reality upheld, and it has been upheld through the centuries by great thinkers, great philosophers, great teachers. But I think it will be worthwhile if we investigate this carefully, putting aside all our preconceptions and assumptions about it, and bearing in mind that we are so conditioned mentally that our own mind, as we consider it, will throw up all kinds of arguments about it. But let us try this afternoon to be perfectly calm and quiet and consider the matter. Not merely discuss it like two intellectuals taking two opposite sides and discussing or arguing away about it, but consider it deeply with the attitude that investigating attitude of mind which is concerned with seeing the truth. Now, if appearance is different from reality, and if appearance deceives us with respect to reality, then it could well be that there are two quite separate things which have no relationship between them, apart from the fact that the one deceives us and the other is not supposed to deceive us. That would postulate something like two unconnected, unrelated absolutes. Is that possible? If that were so, we ourselves would live in an everlasting split condition. since we experience both, or at least we think we experience both, appearance and sometimes reality. Now you see, this is extremely important. If there are two absolutes, one of which is deceptive and the other is supposed to be not deceptive, only one of them is the truth, the fact. But if only one of them is the fact, how can two absolutes exist at all? Appearance on the one hand, reality on the other hand. Now, let us look at another aspect of this. Because I am constituted as I am, I have my various sense organs. Whatever I see or hear or touch or in the ordinary way experience through the senses is something which appears to me. We use the word appear to cover here. Let me repeat that. We will be using the word appearance to cover all that is conveyed to us through the ordinary senses, the five senses that we have. Now, when something is conveyed to us through the senses, it is not a direct perception of that which sends us this impression about itself. It is not a direct perception. There is an image made on the screen of our own mind. So, when I see an object, hear a sound, or taste something, I am not directly experiencing it. I get a mental impression, a psychical impression. And it is that of which I am conscious. My mind inevitably does that. It cannot escape doing that because the mind, whatever that may be, works through this instrument which we call the brain. And the brain is a reality. You can crack open my skull and take out my brains. There they are. Of course, there wouldn't be any use afterwards if you try to put them back. But the fact remains that the brain is the instrument which coordinates the sense impressions which go via the nerves and so forth. And because we have been trained from infancy to speak our own language and associate words with the different impressions of sight, hearing, touch and so on, we make a picture. This coordinated picture of that which we say we see or hear or touch, etc. And it is this which is actually, in my own consciousness, the appearance. Now bear that in mind very carefully. Now, supposing a million people are watching a particular event for, say, 1 minute or 5 minutes, let us say. If all those million people now gave an account in detail of the appearance which they saw, those million accounts would be different. But obviously, the event in itself was just one thing. How is it then that the million accounts are different? So you see, the particular individual is more responsible for what the appearance is and means to him than the appearance itself, the event itself which took place. Now let us look at the other side, which we call reality. What do I call reality? Something which I conceive of and postulate as reality. I say, oh, this is only an appearance. The reality is, or I say that the underlying reality is so and so. But what is this underlying reality? Assume that there is something which is an underlying reality. Is it the underlying reality that I am talking about, or my conception of it, which I name the underlying reality? Now you see, again it comes back to me, the person. It is I who am, as we say in the ordinary way, seeing the appearance. It is I who am seeing and or postulating the reality. Like the hundreds of millions of people in the world, I say, oh, the appearances are deceptive, the reality is so and so. But now, who's making the separation? Or where does the separation actually lie? Does the separation actually lie in the fact in itself? Or does the separation lie in my own imperfect, muddled mode of awareness, mode of consciousness? Is not the split really in me myself? Because I am not yet sufficiently developed, sufficiently grown to know the fact as the whole fact without any flaws in my perception and experiencing. It is very important for us to get hold of this. Through the ages, we have separated appearance from reality. And we have never looked into this question, or never looked sufficiently deeply and clearly into this question of the split in our own awareness, our own mind. See, the fact, the whole fact of the universe is just one whole fact of the universe, isn't it? Whatever that may be. I am the experiencer through the sense organs and functions and the activity of the discursive mind through the instrumentality of the brain, through speech, I am the observer and experiencer, and I am the person who describes that and also postulates the other thing which I call reality. In short, I myself am not whole, but I base my life upon this teaching that this is the unreal and that mysterious something is the real, which I will be in touch with, or to which I will become fully related if I undergo such and such a discipline, or live the holy life, or such and such a life, or train myself as a logical analyst, or some such stuff. There have been just a very few pointers to something which is whole and complete. You will find it in the deep teachings of the Upanishads. You will find it in the Buddhist presentation. I doubt whether you will find it expounded so clearly and so considerably anywhere else as it is in Hinduism and Buddhism. In the Upanishadic presentation, you will find it stated that the one reality stands outside itself by self-constriction and produces the appearance of a whole becoming process, a total world process. Whatever that ultimate reality is, it has this power to constrict itself. And in the constriction, differences come up. The more constricted part, the less constricted part. When the part is sufficiently constricted, it is obviously a separate, finite, particular something. And then the rest is what we commonly call the empty space which contains it. We get the duality of container and contained. But both those duals came out of the one ultimate real. But if they came out of the one ultimate real, neither of them has become an unreal. They are both part of the total reality. If I can be conscious, flawlessly conscious, of the fact of container and contained, I would never separate appearance from reality. In the Buddhist presentation, you get mostly the so-called negative aspect presented. All this which I experience here now is not the Atta. The Sanskrit Atma, the ultimate real. And it is not the Atta, not because it is utterly and totally different from the Atta, because then it would be another absolute on its own, but because it is a changing appearance of, and this is what the Buddhist teaching won't say outright, of that which is the unchanging, the immutable, as we call it. I hope you're able to sort of follow the argument. It is rather difficult, but it is very necessary that we do really understand this. So, the Buddha himself says quite openly that Nirvana is an absolute. It is not dependent upon anything. Its non-dependence means actually its self-subsistence. Subsists by virtue of itself. And if it subsists by virtue of itself, it is utterly free of any limitations in terms of time, space, causation, matter, process, anything at all. And the extraordinary thing is that Buddhist philosophy also postulates Akasha as an absolute. Now, this Akasha is taken over from the Brahmanical teachings, absolutely. It is that out of which all this emerges. But all this, which is the changing, etc., is put aside. We are told not to grasp at it in Buddhist teaching, simply because it is the relative, the impermanent. And why should we, with right wisdom, as it is called, with insight, panya, not grasp at any of this? Because by not grasping it, the absolute, the nirvana, is realized. So much as far as the Theravada presentation goes. When you come to Mahayana, all this, the becoming process, which is the appearance, which is supposed to be deceptive and all the rest of it, is equated. In fact, it is identified with Nirvana. Nirvana and samsara are an identity. So you see, both in the Brahmanical teachings in the Upanishads, I say Brahmanical because what we commonly call Hinduism is the name which sprang up after the interaction with the Buddha's teaching, and from about the 3rd century BC onwards, it began to be called Hinduism. The original Vedic teaching from the Rig Veda right down to the Upanishads sees all the Brahmanical teaching. So in the Brahmanical teaching and in the Buddhist teaching, we have these pointers. If we could really understand this clearly, understand it in depth, which means not merely see it externally, objectively, by means of the intellect, but sensitively feel the reality of it inside ourselves, if we can do this, extraordinary things happen. we immediately become free of a senseless conflict between outer and inner, self and not self, the truth and the untruth, the right and the wrong, between reality and appearance, the worthwhile, nirvana, and the not worthwhile, this world. You see, we are not very sensible, are we? We are trying to escape from the conflict of duality, whilst at the same time allowing this awareness in terms of duality to be perpetuated right in the deeps of our consciousness. Nirvana, samsara, chuck out the one, take hold, grab hold of the other, and so forth. You can't do it. We get split personalities that way. This is the schizophrenic tendency. Now we must be careful. I said we split up right, wrong, and I am suggesting that we shouldn't split it up. In terms of totality, in terms of the altogether whole, there is no separation between them. But in terms of the particular context in which we live, the particular context in which our mind and consciousness functions, there are comparisons, measurements, gradations, and so forth. And why should there be these comparisons and gradations and measurements? Because it is characteristic of whatsoever manifests life, as we understand life in the ordinary sense, to grow. And growth means change. But if there is to be change, there is necessarily a trend of the change. If that trend promotes a coming to fruition, we call it good. If it prevents or destroys the coming to fruition, we call it bad. So within the limited context, there is the element of this way rather than that way. But unless we have clearly deep in our awareness, the wholeness which subsumes the particular, we shall always be stuck in the state of conflict only. Appearance and reality, samsara and nirvana, what is evil and what is good. And therefore, we shall always remain producers of dukkha, of the ill state. Haven't I said again and again, it is totality, it is the wholeness, it is eternity, which through us, through undergoing the separation and then realizing the unity in terms of consciousness, which is coming to fruition all the time. Not I. I said a little while ago that one extraordinary thing which happens to us, if we really understand this, is that such a tremendous element of conflict in us disappears. If that conflict in us disappears, what can follow but right action? What can be the state of the mind, of the psyche, but the state of true love, understanding, hyphenate the two, the karuna prajna state? It is the state of enlightenment. In terms of totality, manifesting itself through the becoming process, this person or this cat being suddenly run over by a motor car or something like that is a terrible event, painful, horrible. Of course, we do what is possible to prevent that. In terms of the totality, totality doesn't care. But in terms of our particular limited sphere of consciousness and our human relationships and so on, we say, no, this rather than that. And we rightly say it. Why rightly? Because if we just use the cold intellectual attitude, held to the cold intellectual attitude and said, oh, in the totality it doesn't matter, we remain callous, and the sources of producing evil and suffering in our human sphere and life. That is why. So you see, the relative morality is of fundamental importance to us as we are. The absolute morality, the transcendental ethic, will naturally manifest itself when relative morality has come to perfection, to fruition. Now, if we do understand this as deeply as we can, understand it, feel it, feel it with the heart, see it with the intellect. If we do understand this, then living the religious life will no longer be a play acting or just a little self-indulgence. Consider the bulk of human beings who go to the temple and the church and this, that and the other and the mosque and whatnot, and go through all the ritual and so forth. In millions of cases, it is sincerely motivated. Of course it is sincerely motivated. But even in those cases where it is sincerely motivated, there is a fair degree of play-acting about it. The very fact that it is the very fact that after the process one feels nice about it, we are smugly complacent inwardly about it, is one of the evidences of the play acting. If it was wholly real, there would be no reaction out of us afterwards. No reaction whatsoever. What would happen is that we ourselves would be completely transformed into something which shows spiritual growth and fruition. And if that takes place, there is no room in the mind, in the feelings, for feeling nice about it. No room whatever. no room in fact for vanity or egoism. You see, doesn't this tie up with the fact that whilst up to a point we do care for the religious life, we don't really care with that complete self-forgetfulness, that utter abandon to the reality, to the truth. If we cared that way, oh my God. Our daily news would be totally different in quality from what the daily news is and has been and will continue to be for quite a long time. It would be a transformed world because we are transformed. Now, let us look into the central point, the central practical point in connection with all this. The great teachers were people whose minds were completely purified. Completely purified. In the words of the Buddha, speaking about himself, for instance, they were beings not liable to delusion. They were beings, you'll find this all in detail in the long discourses, look in the third volume. Page 128, is it somewhere there? They were beings incapable of harming, of taking what was not freely given, of any sort of sense indulgence, quite different from the right use of the senses, remember, which will bring the sensations of pleasure and pain, of joy and sorrow with them, of course. But sense indulgence is the point. Sensuality really means sense indulgence. They were incapable of being untruthful, malicious, gossipy, slanderous, and so forth. They were incapable of a course of action born of fear, of stupidity, and so on. The Buddha says this in detail. Such were the people who were the perfected holy ones. Their minds were completely purified. Their whole being was a pure being. They were, in short, true humans. No longer subhuman, partly bestial, partly human. Now you see, try and let the mind just sense what it means to be someone like that. Feel it. Not liable to delusion. One in whom the virtues function transcendentally. Now, because they themselves were like that, they really knew the state of the psyche in which perfection had been realized. I, the ordinary man in the world, don't know what it means to have a psyche like that. I may picture it, but my pictures will inevitably be tainted, will inevitably be distorted by my own shortcomings and my conditioning. But the Holy Ones knew what was meant by the perfect psyche, the perfected mind, the holy mind. They also knew, if the perfected Holy One stood in front of me, he would know what my psyche is like. And he would see its blemishes, he would see where it is not so blemished, and so forth. So his psychology would not only include what we commonly bandy about as psychology and psychological penetration and all the rest of it, but it would be subsumed in the perfection of the utterly purified holy mind which they themselves had. Now this is a very important point. It is in the light of the perfected psyche that the Holy Ones laid down the simple moralities. Now you see, for us, the moralities are relative. Take the first one, if you like, harmlessness. In the Mosaic Commandments, you have it stated in its most dramatic form, thou shalt not kill. But the way the Hindus and the Buddhists presented it was, abstain from all harming, in any shape or form. And they said, in thought and feeling, in speech and in action, abstain from all harming. Now, I as I am, living and acting in the world, I may do this, and I may say to myself, oh, I'm not harming anybody. Would Jesus or the Buddha or Krishna or Zarathustra agree with me that I'm not harming? I confess, very likely he would not. Why? I as I am, after all, am in darkness, in confusion. I can't see sufficiently truly, sufficiently completely. But the perfected Holy One can. Now, if you have appreciated this point, you will see the extraordinary importance of the observance of the simple moralities. Their observance, unconditioned by my conditioning, which of course is the difficulty. It's asking me to do something which one might ordinarily say was a superhuman task. But that would be a mistake on my part, to say that it is a superhuman task. The perfected Holy Ones certainly knew better than I do. And if they said, carry on like this, laddie, they knew what they were saying. And they knew it was possible. They themselves had done it. Now, if the simple moralities are fully lived like this, then the whole appearance of our living process is the perfect representative of what a person ordinarily would call the whole reality. The appearance and the reality are absolutely identical. This is the presentation, the limited presentation of reality as something perfect, as conceived by the human mind. If you want to take the totality as such, as a philosopher, in which humanity plays only a particular part, then you will see that in fact, whatsoever happens anywhere in the universe, the appearance of what happens is the reality itself. They are not two separate things. It is we who are constantly cutting up into two and more parts that which is whole in itself. Do you see how different life would be? It is because we have our particular conceptions, our particular pictures of the real, of the good, of the true, of the beautiful, that we bend our efforts towards producing the expression of that picture. And if you look sufficiently deeply into it, it will be seen that this picture stems, almost 90 or 95% of it stems, only out of vanity and egoism and pleasure lust. If vanity and egoism and pleasure lust disappeared, there'd be pure beauty only. You look at the creation of a great artist, a musician, a painter, a sculptor, a poet. You look at that creation. It is perfection, isn't it? And why is it so perfect? Because in the act of creating this obtruding, intrusive selfness had completely vanished. And therefore, that which was produced was marvelous, beyond description. And is not this happiness? Or is it the chasing of my particular picture of happiness? Happiness. Haven't we all noticed that whenever we chase our particular picture of happiness, we may obtain sensational delight if, as we say, we are successful in being happy. And at the end of it, that sensational delight has just become dust and ashes. There is a residue left over. But in pure happiness, there is no leftover, there is no residue. Because pure happiness was never born. Therefore it never dies. But it is self-subsistent, the eternal reality. Look, do try and get hold of this. Do try and experience it sometime. Because then you will really know why, in all the great religions, God, Brahman, is presented also, amongst other things, as bliss. And this is the meaning of it. It is the unchaseable, the ungraspable. Let be what is already there in perfection. And we can let be what is already there in perfection if we can be free of this conflict of duality which we out of our own ignorance perpetuate. Appearance and reality. There is only the one total reality which will include all that we say about it in its own way. Let be. The holy life is fundamentally concerned with becoming, with awakening to all that obstructs the holiness. Hence the simple moralities. And why so much the simple moralities? Because they touch our psyche, the mind. And what distinguishes us, what controls our life from beginning to end, basically, is the psyche. All sense impressions are psychical. The impression itself is a psychical phenomenon. All thoughts, plans, schemes, beliefs, understanding, knowledge, everything is of the mind, is of the psyche. And what transforms the psyche is morality in the religious context. Just one other word. What is the meaning of morality? Customary action. The customs comes from the Latin mos and the plural mores. Mos, moris, the singular. And mores, the customs. Customary action is morality. So let customary action be performed with one's whole being totally dedicated to the reality, uninterfered with by our pictures and preconceptions and assumptions and all the rest of it. And we shall have realized our true humanity.